This is Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, as the debate continues, I think most people are eager to take a look at the healthcare bill themselves. Every party I attend, I'm being asked, what's in that bill? Well, for those of you who would like a copy of the Reconciliation Act of 2010, it's now available. Just go to the Library of Congress website, www.thomas.loc.gov. All 900 pages at your fingertips.
Well, Mark, I have to admit that I printed out a copy of the whole bill. I really want to go through it line by line, and I hope Americans will give it a read, even if it's just a few of those pages or people just search for the items that are of particular interest to them. We know the country is still all over the place on how they view this health care reform. It's certainly one of the things we'll have to wait and keep assessing as it unfolds, but we just can't encourage people enough to understand what's in the bill.
Now, we want them to be green, so we're not encouraging everyone to print them out. But I think you're right about having to have people take a look at this bill in detail. And the polls are all over the place, but there was one poll that the Commonwealth Fund did, and they were taking the opinion of healthcare leaders and policymakers, and they found that this group of people were very optimistic about the new healthcare legislation.
Well, it was a pretty select group of leaders who really understand healthcare, and I think they came at it from this perspective. If we successfully cover the uninsured, we will, as the Institute of Medicine has said for years, have taken the first and most important step towards ensuring access and affordable health care. Now, those folks did note that in the short term, there are some issues. The nation's supply of primary care providers, the ability of the states to actually implement reform, and also enforcing that individual mandate. These are all areas of concern that people who understand the legislation still have.
You know, and they really do. And I think it's best characterized by Karen Davis's statement, who's the president of the Commonwealth Fund and has been a guest here on Conversations, when she said, you know, the U.S. will now join all other major industrialized countries with a system for ensuring access to essential health care.
And that's something certainly that the healthcare economists have been fighting for a long time, many of them as both an economic rationality issue and also as a moral issue. So I think we conclude it's a new era in American healthcare. We have a lot to look forward to. And at the end of the day, healthcare reform is all about making Americans healthier, building healthier communities, building a healthier America.
Speaking of making Americans healthier, First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, which is designed to give parents support they need, provide healthier foods in school, and help kids be more physically active, is really the forerunner of the preventative focus that's embedded in that health reform bill. On Monday, the First Lady and the President hosted the annual White House Easter egg roll. I wish I was there. But with a twist, or a theme, I should say, to promote health and wellness. They called it Ready, Set, Go. The event featured music, sports, cooking stations, and, of course, the Easter egg roll.
Well, I'm glad they kept that Easter egg roll. Eggs are a perfectly healthy food. And all these activities, the fitness, the healthy eating, and social interaction, all these things encourage kids to be more active. And they follow the First Lady's national campaign, Let's Move, which is all about curbing childhood obesity, which everyone knows we've got to do.
Speaking of keeping us healthy, our guest today has an interesting perch on the impact health reform is having on healthcare, medicine, and our society. President-elect of the American Medical Association, Dr. Cecil Wilson, is here to talk about the AMA's support for the bill and how the much-needed change in our healthcare system will improve how doctors practice medicine. Dr. Wilson will assume the office of the AMA presidency in June 2010, just as the benefits of the healthcare reform legislation start taking effect.
Well, I think Dr. Wilson's probably going to have one of the most interesting presidencies of the AMA in recent history. We wish him well. No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get the show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak to Dr. Wilson, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The Easter egg roll hosted by the White House on Monday focused on something the President and First Lady can't get enough of, promoting health and wellness.
We've got football. We've got basketball.
The annual event featured music, sports, cooking stations, and of course, Easter egg rolling for the children. Activities that encourage healthier and more active living. The theme follows the First Lady's Let's Move initiative, a national campaign to combat childhood obesity that she launched back in February. President Obama gave his 2 cents after reading aloud to the children the classic Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss.
Eat your peach.
Just try.
You gotta try it out.
The event seemed to appropriately follow the recent passage of health care reform legislation that the president just signed into law. And President Obama continues to promote its benefits. He spoke to a crowd in Portland, Maine last week and framed the legislation as an essential part of the country's economic recovery, with particular benefits for small business owners who have been hit hard by a weak economy. President Obama says one key benefit of his health care overhaul is a tax credit for small companies that supply their workers with insurance.
This health care tax credit is pro-jobs, it's pro-business, and it starts this year.
The credit is based on the size of the company. Businesses with fewer than 25 employees will get a tax credit, up to 35% of the company's share of their total health care premium. Businesses with 50 or more workers must offer coverage or pay a penalty of $750 per worker. Companies with 26 to 49 workers do not qualify. Some potential glitches to this system are still being worked out, however. For companies with more than 50 employees, the penalty fee per worker is actually less than what the business would be spending on health care for that worker. Not much of an incentive to offer coverage to everyone. The Senate is considering an increase in the $750 penalty to prevent that scenario. We spoke last week about the potential nomination of Don Berwick to direct the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Although the appointment is not yet official, the healthcare community is hailing the prospect of his leadership. Stuart Altman, a leading healthcare economist and professor at Brandeis University, couldn't be happier.
I don't know any other American that has had the impact on our healthcare system that Don Berwick has had. I mean, he created IHI, this Institute for Healthcare Improvement, to focus primarily on increasing safety and the quality of care. And according to many estimates, as a result of the work that he and his staff have done, more than 100,000 Americans a year are alive as a result of the delivery system becoming more concerned with safety and with improving the basic level of care so the quality improves.
Carrie Weems, who spent 25 years in senior roles at the Health and Human Services Department and was acting administrator of CMS from September 2007, went further and said, if Don Berwick is confirmed as administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, he and David Blumenthal, the national coordinator for Health IT, would be a dream team in pursuing a coherent national health care and health IT strategy. Blumenthal is already leading the campaign to direct the use of health IT in ways that would yield scientifically relevant data on healthcare treatment and practices.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with the American Medical Association President-elect Dr. Cecil Wilson. Dr. Wilson, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Many books have been written about the history of efforts to reform healthcare in America over the past century. I think it's fair to say that the AMA has generally been portrayed as being in opposition to health reform. That wasn't the case this year. The American Medical Association went on record as being in support of President Obama's healthcare reform legislation. Was this shift about the content of legislation, or do you think it reflects a fundamental change in the culture, beliefs, and practices of the current generation of physicians?
This time, what we said at the AMA was that the need for health system reform was an imperative, that the current system was not serving our country, the patients, or the physicians who take care of them. And so I think it's unfair to say we signed on to the president's plan. What we did was to say we want to support efforts at meaningful health system reform. And we will work with the administration and with Congress, House, and the Senate to make that happen.
Dr. Wilson, over the course of the many hours of televised debate on the health reform legislation, we heard from several physician members of Congress. And when I think back on the debates, I don't recall any of them really speaking in favor of the legislation that was passed. Instead, we heard, again, the fears of government intrusion, socialization of health care, potential for negative impact on physicians and patients, things that were consistent with more of the past. Tell us about your work or the AMA's work with the physician members of Congress. Did you have an opportunity to dialogue with them over the past year? And what are the things that came out that you think were the good outcomes of this legislation?
So I think the debate among physicians has reflected that in the country. And the answer to the question about our reaching out to physicians is that we have, both in Congress and elsewhere, to try to come to some agreement about what should happen. And what is really good about the legislation is that tens of millions of Americans who currently do not have health insurance and as a result are at a greater risk of being sicker when they get care and of dying sooner will have coverage. In the end, the AMA did not expect to get everything we thought was needed. And we looked at the package and said, on balance, there is so much here that is good that we need to come on board and accept and urge passage, understanding that we really are at the start of a process which is going to go on over the coming 4 or 5 years or more as we implement what was passed and also make improvements on it.
Dr. Wilson, that's a great summary of the benefits of the bill, but there's also some huge investments in medical education and training, particularly for primary care providers. The patient-centered medical home gets a lot of attention, as do investments in public health efforts to reduce obesity, stop tobacco use, and increase physical activity. How successful do you think these elements of health reform will be in creating a more satisfied medical community and a healthier American public?
Well, first of all, I think physicians, even physicians who are now uncomfortable or even angry about the legislation, are going to find that their lives are going to be better. I think having patients who are insured and who have more choice of plans and having the administrative simplifications and insurance reform is going to make life a lot better. The items that you listed, which I would say are extremely important, if all we did for health system reform is to provide coverage and do some insurance reforms, we actually may end up making the system worse because we would not have addressed issues related to workforce, and you mentioned that, related to primary care. We would not have addressed issues related to care, sort of the epidemic of health behaviors that are causing disease in this country, the alcohol abuse, cigarette smoking, obesity. So all of those things are very important. And then the other one, which you also mentioned, having to do with workforce, what we call workforce issues, and that is that not only do we have a shortage of physicians in the country, but we also have a shortage which is even more marked in primary care. So there is a lot in this bill in terms of bonuses for primary care, for continued pilot projects for the so-called patient-centered medical home that I think in the end are going to be very important for the success of health system reform as well as the satisfaction of physicians and patients.
Let me ask you, your organization is perhaps the best-known physician organization in the United States, but other groups have formed, including physician groups, that absolutely champion a single-payer or a single national health program as the only way we'll ever really control costs, improve quality, and get to universal coverage. How does the AMA view that platform, and what do you say to this group of physicians within the physician community about the progress that we have made with passage of this bill?
Well, I would remind them that one of the laments of the late Senator Ted Kennedy was that when he and President Nixon were working on the possibility of health reform, that he did not meet him halfway, that they did not come to an agreement, mm-hmm. that he sort of made the perfect the enemy of the good. I think the position of the AMA is that for our country, that a single-payer, government-run system would not work, that the size of this country, the diversity of this country, puts us in a different place from some other countries around the world.
Today we're speaking with the American Medical Association President-elect Dr. Cecil Wilson. Health reform will increase the number of people who are covered by Medicaid. And one of the most striking elements of the bill
that only appeared in the reconciliation legislation was the provision moving Medicaid payment rates up to 100% of the Medicare standard. That has the potential to bring many more primary care doctors into caring for the Medicaid population and insurance that the majority of physicians for a long time shun because of its historically low reimbursement rates. First of all, how did that come into play in the last minute, and do you think it will have its desired effect?
The history of that is that actually it's some $50 to $57 billion, which, as you indicated, would require primary care payments under Medicaid to be at least equal to that of Medicare. That was in the House legislation. Putting it in the reconciliation bill was one of those things that the House did to put some things in legislation that the House had felt was very important. Mm-hmm. You know, just taking an example from Medicaid, payments vary among the states, depending on, as far as coverage and payments. That has meant nationwide that the numbers of physicians who could afford to provide care for Medicaid patients has been a challenge. And we are certainly hopeful that this really significant amount of money will help with that and also help to respond to the other observation, and that is that a part of the increased coverage for all the uninsured is an expansion of the level of coverage for Medicaid up to 133% of the federal poverty line. I guess the other observation there that is important, and that is that Medicaid for states is a big budget buster, mm-hmm. and states are challenged by that, and what this legislation does is to anticipate that so that at least for the first 2 or 3 years, the federal government will pick up all of the cost of this expanded coverage, and then subsequent to that, there will be a gradual tapering down of that coverage. As you know now, it's a state-federal match, and I think that's why you have not seen a lot of the governors just really yelling and screaming about this, because they do recognize that, at least early on, there will actually be increased funds coming to their states from which they will benefit, and then I'm sure as time goes on, they will be looking to preserve that as modifications continue to come down the
pipe. That they will.
They will. Dr. Wilson, when we look at so much of how medical care is organized and delivered, and this moves away a little bit from the health reform issue, it just doesn't seem to have quite evolved the way other sectors in our society and economy have. Still, most practices don't have electronic health records. Virtual visits are a rarity. And most practices are still in the small, independently owned business category. And at the same time, social networks and the use of various health-related apps are in widespread use by the public, our patients, for everything from support for living with a chronic illness to monitoring diet and vital signs. Outside the U.S., mobile phones are being used in healthcare for everything from remote monitoring to ultrasound to tracking infectious disease. So it seems like medicine has made enormous strides in the most complex technology for diagnostics and treatment, but somehow that hasn't come down to the level of primary care or community practice. We'd be really interested in your thoughts on this technical divide within healthcare, and is it just a matter of time until the next generation of physicians coming up changes all that?
Well, I think it is a matter of time, and I hope that as people think about that and think that that's going to be helpful, and I think we all do. I think better coordination, better interaction will be helpful, but it is going to take time because the demographics of practice in this country are that it's still the case that something around 51 or 52% of the physicians in this country are practicing in groups of three or less, and they're practicing in a variety of areas, both urban and rural. And so that demographic means that as we look at ways that we can take advantage of increased communication and working together, you've got to get around that challenge.
Dr. Wilson, you have a great view of what's happening in healthcare around the world. What do you see that's transformational, that excites you, and who should our listeners be paying attention to?
We recognize now, and you referred to it earlier, that a lot of the illness we have is illness we bring on ourselves. Mm-hmm. If you look, the CDC did some work where they looked at health, the determinants of health behaviors, and what they found was that for our population, only 10% of the determinant of health behavior had to do with access to care. So the treatment in the hospital and the doctor's office. 20% had to do with your genetic inheritance, the parents you chose or or did not choose, and 20% had to do with environment, so the things like clean water, food, things of that sort. 50% of the determinants of the health of our population has to do with health behaviors. And so cigarette smoking, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, alcohol abuse, those are all things that people do that contribute mightily to the cost of health care and to illness in the country. And so just one example there, obesity-induced type 2 adult type 2 diabetes, $140 billion a year that we spend on that. 10 or 15 years ago, it was not on the radar screen. So I think one of the exciting things is to is how we're going to engage society, and certainly the First Lady, Michelle Obama, is with her initiative related to childhood obesity, is sort of raising that level. I think we have to focus on that, and that's going to be a job for society in general, not only and not just physicians and healthcare workers, but everyone.
Thanks, Dr. Wilson. And let me get your thoughts on community health centers for a moment, if we can. As you know, the health reform legislation has just an unprecedented investment in funding the growth and expansion of community health centers, in developing some very exciting new models of the teaching health center with residencies for all the various health professionals. And we're curious your thoughts on the role of the community health centers in this changing landscape of primary care in the United States, particularly with this new investment. What is it really signaling to the country?
Well, I think it's part of the whole mosaic, if you will, of the things we're going to have to do, and that is we're going to have to provide care to people where they are and under the circumstances they're in, and so that the advantage of things like community health centers is frequently is responding to a need in underserved areas, also providing a coordination of care, a coordination of health professionals. The public health kind of needs of the community service, in a way, has atrophied over the years, I think, to our disadvantage, and so I would see this as a positive thing.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Cecil Wilson, President-elect of the American Medical Association. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Wilson.
Well, thank you so much. It was my privilege.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a new program that's combating Alzheimer's disease even before it develops. A group of researchers at UC Santa Barbara recently launched a new initiative called Cognitive Fitness and Innovative Therapies, or CFIT, which takes a comprehensive approach to cognitive health. CFIT specifically aims at preventing Alzheimer's disease, one of the most debilitating and widespread cognitive illnesses. Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disorder responsible for most dementia cases. Currently affects 5.3 million Americans. Because the patient's decline is often swift and unstoppable, once symptoms appear, CFIT seeks to prevent Alzheimer's before the first warning signs even appear. CFIT guides participants, typically aged 50 to 80, through a wide variety of strategies for both treatment and prevention. Participants are coached on how to eat healthy. Mediterranean diets, which help keep blood pressure and cholesterol in check, are used. They are trained in how to improve their physical fitness, to strengthen their minds. They also play mental fitness computer games. And as part of CFIT's holistic approach to cognitive health, a non-denominational chaplain is available on-site to participants for counseling and guidance. Another key component of the program is a focus on building social relationships between participants. Consistent social contact plays a vital role in staying healthy, especially later in life. With that in mind, CFIT organizes groups of participants to use the facilities at the same time every week so they can get to know each other. CFIT is also in the process of creating a social networking website for participants. This site will play a dual role. It will facilitate communications between participants, and by enabling people to log their diet and exercise habits, it will allow researchers to gain important data about the program's effectiveness. CFIT's membership is growing, and participants are already reporting maintained or improved mental and physical health. Also, because the families and friends of Alzheimer's patients are often suffering physical and emotional stress, the benefits of this improved Alzheimer's prevention
can be far-reaching, making our communities healthier and happier overall. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.